Good Vach, and Shavua Tov, everybody. Gmar Chasima Tova. And thank you so much for joining me for the Shabbat Shuvah Drasha for this year. I'd like to begin by expressing how grateful I am that I was able this evening to deliver this shiur in person. And since it has been 2 years since I have been able to deliver such a drasha in person, it was really incredibly gratifying to be able to share Torah and to gather on such a special occasion with so many people from the community. At the same time, I recognize that there are those who are listening right now who perhaps were unable to join us for a whole variety of reasons. And so, as part of a silver lining to the last couple of years is I have now had the opportunity to reflect upon sharing certain drushas of this nature using this medium, and so therefore I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do so, and I thank you so much for joining me. Tonight what I'd like to do is share a topic with you that relates to that which is hopefully on all of our minds, a topic which is should be something we think about all throughout the year, but particularly during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and that is the topic, of course, of tshuva, of repentance. Now, I want to begin by acknowledging and by stating that which is perhaps obvious to each and every one of us, and that is tshuva, which is tshuva is something which is very, very difficult to understand. Of course, we can relate to the concept of forgiveness maybe in a general sense, but the idea that we can just go ahead and correct actions by words is something which raises, I think, more questions than it provides answers. The notion that we can speak about starting again with the clean slate, a fresh start, a new beginning, you know, how does that work? How is it possible for me to engage in habitual acts of sin over the course of many, many weeks, months, years, perhaps over the course of my lifetime, and then go ahead and just do something, whatever that something may be, and all of a sudden fix it, correct it through the process of tshuva? The truth of the matter is, this is not my question. I am not the first one to ask, you know, how is this even possible? Our rabbis were bothered by this, and in many instances spoke about the miracle of tshuva, the fact that tshuva on a certain level is something which really cannot be properly understood. Yesterday I had the opportunity to share briefly before Shabbos with my father-in-law, Rabbi Yudin, what it is that I'll be talking about today. And he said, make sure to tell everybody, and so therefore I'm telling you in his name, B'shem Rav Nevensol, that the Torah refers to Yom HaKippurim as being a chukas olam. In what respect is Yom Kippur a chok? In what respect it is a chok? Where is it a chok? So it could be partially in this respect, and that is the notion that we can go ahead and just fix, correct our misdeeds of the past by showing up to shul and going through the process of tshuva, whatever that may be. That is a chok. That is not something that makes sense, and it really, while we find great inspiration in the possibility that that idea exists, it's really something that sort of boggles the mind. I would like to share my screen with you right now, and a lot of marmakomos that I'm going to be sharing with you tonight, but most of which we will not be actually reviewing inside together. But just to highlight a few, the Gemara in Pesachim, in source number 1, tells us that tshuva was created before the creation of the world. Now, it's difficult to understand even what that means. After all, tshuva is not an object that is created. But the idea that Chazal are probably trying to convey over here is that indeed the notion of tshuva is something which really, on a certain level, doesn't make all that much sense. It doesn't fit, it doesn't conform with our understanding of reality, namely that a person can go ahead and willfully and intentionally over the course of time commit many, many sins, and then go ahead and then do something to make it right. That's something that, in fact, doesn't fit into the world order the way we know it. And so therefore, Chazal tell us that it was created before the world. It does, in fact, transcend or precede time and space. It is not subject to the same rules of nature the way that we know them. The Gemara in Yerushalmi, Maseches Makos, in source number 3, tells us that if you would ask wisdom, so to speak, if you would ask a wise person, Chote Mahu Onsho, what should be the consequence of a person who sins? So we quote from Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men in Mishlei, who basically tells us that the consequences should be pretty severe, that a person who has sinned should be pursued by the very painful and difficult consequences that naturally flow from such actions. You know, you could make choices in life, but you can't choose those consequences. Says the Gemara, Shelu l'nevua chotei ma'on. If you would ask prophecy, if you would ask a prophet, what should be the onesh? The Navi Yechezkel tells us, ha'nefesh ha'chatas hitamus, which basically means a person sins, the consequence should be death. However, Shalu l'kud shebarichu, when you ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu chotei mahu onsho, what should be the onesh? So Amar lehen, yasu tshuva b'yischaper lo. Says the Gemara, quoting a pasuk, HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs us to do tshuva. So, it's difficult. It's difficult to understand how exactly that works and why that should be. If you think that is true in general, then I think you'll agree it's even more true in light of what I'm going to share with you this evening. The Gemara in Masachas Yoma Daf Pei Vav teaches that there are many, many really incredible aspects of tshuva. The Gemara tells us in the name of Chami Bar Chanina that tshuva is so great that it brings healing to the world. Rabbi Levi says tshuva is so great that it reaches the Kisei HaKavod. Rabbi Yonasan says that it brings the Geula. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani says that it extends the life of man. So Chazal are speaking over here, perhaps in hyperbole, perhaps not, but how incredible tshuva is. Again, tshuva is a miracle. The fact that it exists and how it exists and what it affords us. But we haven't even gotten, like I said, to the best part yet. Now, before we do, I just want to state the following, and that is that there's a popular conception that we have of tshuva, and it goes something like this. You know, ideally, we behave all the time, and we never sin. But then, of course, as we know, we do. That's part of life. And then comes tshuva, I would say, sort of as a b'dieved, and it's there to address a problem, to fix a situation that has gone wrong. We come to terms with these mistakes, and we commit to change, and we look forward to new beginnings. And then ultimately, when we are successful in our path towards tshuva, then we get a pass, if you will. We get a break. And when we are done, we hope to sort of cut our losses, if you will, and move on. But the goal of tshuva, we would think, we would imagine, would be to essentially do just that, to try to put my troubled past behind me and move on. Take a look at source number 6, which appears in the middle of your page. It comes from that same Gemara in Yom HaDaf Tevav Amid Beis. Amar Reish Lakish, Gedola Tshuva. Tshuva is so great, Shezdonos Nasos Lokish Gagos. He says that the Zdonos, that the willful, intentional acts that we have committed can become converted into Shgagos, can somehow become, even though they were done originally with intent and with ill will, they can become downgraded into a level of a shogeg. We know, for example, in criminal law, there's a concept of murder and manslaughter. Murder implies that it was a premeditated act, that there was intent to kill. Manslaughter is a serious crime, but there was criminal negligence. There was a lack of care and concern and safety. And as a result, there was a death. Now, while both of them are serious crimes, which can carry some very, very serious sentences, there's definitely a difference between the two. There's no death penalty for manslaughter. There are even situations, I believe, in manslaughter where maybe there could be a very, very minimal, maybe no prison sentence at all. You cannot have a situation where a person has been convicted of murder and there be no prison sentence. They're just simply different types of sins. That which is done with bezadon is very severe. That which is done b'shogeg, while it is still a sinful act, it is less severe. And over here, Reish Lakish teaches that tshuva is so great that the zdonos can become shgagos. How is that possible? Where does he get this from? So he quotes a pasuk that we read this morning in the Haftarah, Shuva Yisrael ad Hashem Elokecha, return to Hashem, ki chashalta b'avonecha, because you have stumbled upon your avonos, your sins. And the Gemara says, wait a second. An avon is mezid. That's something which is done willfully. You stumble over something you didn't see. So what exactly does it mean that you stumble over something that was done willfully? So Reish Lakish says, initially it was done bezadon, but it becomes converted through the process of tshuva into something that is now considered only a shogeg. The Gemara says, wait a second, does Reish Lakish really teach this? After all, does Reish Lakish not say, gedola tshuva shezdonos nasislo kizchuyos? That tshuva is so powerful that one's donos become merits, that not only are they changed, that they become transformed into shkagos, but even greater than that, they can become zechuyos, as the pasuk says, "B'shuv Rasha mirishaso." When a Rasha does tshuva from his evil ways, v'asam mishpat tzedaka, aleihem yichya, he derives continued life sustenance from them, including even the rishus. So says the Gemara, what do you mean that Rish Lakish says that Zdonos become Shkagos? He teaches over here that Zdazon becomes Zechuyos. Says the Gemara, Lokashia? It's not a question. Kan mi'ava, kan mi'ira. That there are two different types of tshuva. When a person does tshuva mi'ira, when a person does a tshuva at a sense of coercion, compulsion, feeling a certain pressure, so then the Zdonos, I'll say sort of magically, if you will, become Shkagos. When a person does tshuva mi'ava, when a person does tshuva out of a sense of love and a desire and a real yearning to become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then, in certain situations, those zdonos can become zechuyos, they can even become merits. And it is on that point, precisely, that I would like to focus this evening. How is it possible? How could that be? After all, the Marsha over here in source number 9 says, that would mean that a chote could be niskar, that you could have a person who sins who somehow profits in the process, which doesn't make any sense. That goes contrary to everything we understand. After all, even if you want to tell me that there is a way to fix, to correct, to rectify, to be forgiven for past sins, fine. But to profit in the process, to gain, to walk away with more? So how could it be, says the Marsha, the Reish Lakish could teach us, that when a person commits zdonos, intentional, willful acts of sin, that they can be converted into Zechuyos. It really boggles the mind, and it goes against, again, everything that we know about the way the world should be. Similar, perhaps, in some respects, the Gemara in Brachos teaches, in the name of Rav Avohu, the Makom Shebalei Shuva Omdin, Sadikin Gemura Menem Omdin. That you cannot compare the experience, the place of where a Baal Tshuva is Omed, literally Baal Tshuva stands, to that where a Tzadik Gemur will stand. I want you to imagine for a moment that there's a big dinner. For you could say anyone you want. I'm not gonna suggest any names. A major Baal Tshuva organization. Let's say there's a yeshiva, in which there are many people come in. They haven't had much learning in their background. They're not Torah observant Jews, and they come into the yeshiva and they learn and they grow. And the yeshiva is having an annual fundraiser. And so there's a dais. And who sits on the dais? Typically, usually, you see who sits the dais? The Rebbeim, the Rosh Yeshiva, the founders of the yeshiva. And who sits out among the people? Well, the Talmidim of the yeshiva, the benefactors, those who are joining, the friends, the families, the guests, right? So says Rav Avohu, you know who should be at the dais? The Baalei Tshuva. The students, they should be there. B'makom shebaalei tshuva omdin, tzadikim gemurim einam omdin. And here again, it's difficult to understand. Why should that be? Why should it be that a person who's a Baal Tshuva, again, it's wonderful you're Baal Tshuva. There are persons Baal Tshuva. Zdonos nasos lo kizchuyos or kishkagos, as the Gemara says, two possibilities. And that person is standing, so to speak, at a higher place. That person is placed on a pedestal which places them above and beyond, towering over the tzaddikim gemurim. How could that be? And just to sort of put a little bit of a spin on this question, and I share this with you, not really to focus on the issue, because the truth of the matter is, we're not having a halachic conversation tonight, but just to sort of pique your interest, there's somewhat of a, I would say even a little bit of a humorous question over here. Rav Zilberstein brings down the chuk and the Sefer Chashuk Chemed, the following question. There was an individual who's a sofer, he's a sofer stam, he writes Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzos, and he spends most of the day learning, and he writes at night. And as you can imagine, he has a pretty packed schedule. There were times that he would fall asleep really, really late at night, and he would have difficulty waking up in the morning. And his Rebbe, his Rav, noticed that on a rather frequent basis, he was coming late to davening in the morning, and he noticed that he was saying Kriya Shema after Zman Kriya Shema. This was happening not just once in a while, but it was happening on a regular basis. So his Rebbe pulls him aside and says, listen, I know you're working hard, I know you're doing the best you can. The only thing is, when you're selling your Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzot, you're selling them to people who think that you are a genuine Yorei Shamayim. And they're paying top dollar, not just because they like your writing, because the ksav is nice, but they appreciate the fact that it's coming from somebody who they believe to be a genuine Yorei Shamayim. And here, I see that you're, unfortunately, on a regular basis, you're coming late to shul, you're not saying Kriya Shema Bizman. So he says, I think you should sell your product for what it's worth, and you should let people know, listen, it's kosher, but it may not be on the level that you assume. So this sofer got the message, and he felt very bad about what he was doing, and he did tshuva, whatever that means. He did tshuva. Okay? So he's he's fixed his ways. So now he comes back to his Rebbe and he says, okay, listen, I've done tshuva. And the Gemara, as we just saw in Maseches Yoma, teaches tshuva is so great that what happens? Zdonos, nasas kuschuyos. So he says, can I now sell the product that was produced during my, I'll call them, sinful years? Can I sell them at a premium price? Because what should happen is, retroactively, all of those donos should become like schuyos. So now it turns out that not just me as a person, but the entire product gets to sort of this automatic upgrade. So this was his question, which is a very, it's a clever question. Like I said, I don't really want to spend time right now on Rav Zilberstein's answer. I'll tell you very quickly, Rav Zilberstein basically says no, it doesn't work that way. This concept of Zdonot Nasos Keschuyos, that works Ben Adam L'Makom. That's between you and God, but you still have to sell the product down here for what it's worth. So what I'd like to do this evening is present several different approaches to understand exactly what is going on over here. How do we understand this idea? How can we make sense, to the best of our ability, of this idea of Zdonos Nasos Keschuyos? I'm going to present five different approaches. Four of them I'm going to present rather quickly, and then we'll spend more time on the fifth approach. The first approach I will call fuzzy math. We're all familiar with the concept of fuzzy math, which is a term that's used to describe a situation where somebody is presenting numbers in a way where they don't really seem to be adding up. Now, I'm going to begin this by saying, I don't mean to suggest, chas v'shalom, that the Mabit and the Alshech, the Yetz Yosef, the Marsha, the Sfas Emes, that we're going to see in a moment, didn't know how to do basic arithmetic. Of course they did. But you will see that they themselves are struggling in terms of their ability to really, really explain what this means. How is it that Zdonos become Zuchuyos? So the Mabit says, well, what happens is when you sin and you do tshuva, you get the additional benefit of the mitzvah tshuva. And so therefore, you now have Zuchuyos that you wouldn't otherwise have. Okay, but it's not really what Rish Lakish says, but says the Mabit. That's what it means, Shenasos Zuchuyos. The Alshech says similarly, when you do tshuva, osa mitzvos, you do a mitzvah saseh, the mitzvah v'shavta l'shem l'kecha. You have fulfilled the mitzvah of tshuva. The Eitz Yosef in his commentary on the Gemara in Yoma has somewhat of a different explanation over here. He basically explains that when it comes to averos, so down here in our world, we would look at a person's actions in the context of what it was that they were thinking beforehand. Meaning, we would look at a person who carries out a premeditated act as having committed a greater crime than a person who just messed up. It was a crime of passion. It was something that just happened in a moment. There was a momentary lapse of judgment. But interestingly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not do that. There's a concept, Chazal tell us, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not mitztaref machshava l'maseh, which means that when a person does something, there's the machshava, there's the meditation that went into it beforehand, the thought, the planning, the conspiracy, which is a problem in itself, and there's the maseh, there's the action, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu does us the favor of not being mitztaref, the two of them. So therefore, the action is not magnified as much as it would be in light of the fact that the machshava has been sort of taken away from the equation. That's true when it comes to averus. When it comes to mitzvos, Hashem is mitztaref the machshava t'maseh. So says the Yitz Yosef, look what happens. When a person does an avera, so he has a maseh. Comes along the maseh of tshuva and basically absolves one of that sin. It clears away that sin, which leaves me with the machshava of tshuva. And the machshava of tshuva is something which sort of overwhelms the space that I'm in right now, and suddenly it comes out that what? Zdonos nasos keschuyos. Now again, here I'll say, while the Eitz Yosef is trying, and I think in a very, very compelling way, has made a case to understand where the merits come from, where this pshat falls short, we would say, is that it doesn't really, really explain how the avonos themselves can become converted into Zuchuyos. It doesn't really explain. It just says that, listen, there are other factors at play at the moment. The Sfas Emes basically says, listen, a Baal Tshuva is inspired. He's not just inspiring, he's inspired. He's in an inspired state, and so therefore it comes out, Nimtzum mamish donos nasin kamo Zuchuyos. Shayizeh hosef koach v'oz v'zuchuyos. He's on fire, and he's doing lots of good things. But again, I will say, and I say this only with respect, that the Sfas Emes himself would likely acknowledge that the way he is explaining it seems to require a little bit of a twist of Reish Lakish's words and not a corruption of his words, but a little bit of a twist. In other words, he's not literally saying that the zdonos themselves become schuyos, but that there are other factors over here, which in the big scheme of things, make us understand and can appreciate how this Baal Tshuva has reached some very, very high levels. So that's the first approach. The second approach that I'll present, I will call no pain, no gain. What does that mean? So let's just take a step back over here. When a person sins, often there is a certain pleasure that's involved in that chet, whatever the case may be. There's a certain satisfaction. There's something that a person enjoys. And I think that's obvious because otherwise, most often, we wouldn't sin, right? That is what attracts us to sin in the first place. So I'll use an example, which I cannot relate to, and that's why I'm going to use the example. I'm just going to speak about it. I've never had shrimp in my life. I've just never had shrimp. I never tasted shrimp. I don't know what it tastes like. But I've been in a situation where you have people sitting around the table, maybe having sushi, whatever the case may be, and they serve something that's supposed to taste like shrimp. And you have a bunch of people sitting around, and one says, oh, this imitation shrimp, this is great. Shrimp must be really good. And then there's somebody else at the table, or maybe the next table, overhears them and says, I got news for you. This is not what shrimp tastes like. Shrimp doesn't taste anything like this. It's much, much, much better. Now, the Baal Tshuva, who has tasted shrimp, as an example, this is not the only example that, of course, we want to think. So he knows what it is that he is missing. He has tasted that forbidden fruit, so to speak. And so therefore, the struggle that he has to endure in order to stop himself from sinning in the future is greater than a person who never had that struggle in the first place. The Tosefos Yom Kippurim in his Perush on Maseches Yoma tells us, Kevin Shalovra Tom Tamachet. This person tasted the sin, the hikir b'mayim genuvim yimtuku, and he knows the experience that things that you can't have taste better. Afilu hachi pirish mi'averu mi'avas Hashem, but yet he holds himself back. Nimsa the osa averu she'ava kvar garma haprisha z'osa z'chus gado. That doing the averu in the first place put me in a position where now I can exercise restraint. I am able to hold myself back in a way that I couldn't before, and that in of itself gives this Baal Tshuva a tremendous achus that a tzaddik gomor doesn't have. It would seem as if the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva is presenting Tshuva in a very similar light. Says the Rambam in source number 17, you shouldn't think that a Baal Tshuva is meruchak mimalas tzaddikim, that he is somehow distant and far from God and from the level of tzaddikim because of the sins that he has committed. Ein adavar kein, says the Rambam. El ohu v'nechmad hu lefnei abore ki'ilu lochatmi olam. He is beloved before God. Not only that, scharu harbe, he has tremendous schar. Why? Shahre toam tamachet. He tasted the taste of sin. Upiresh mi menu v'kavash yitzro. He holds himself back. He was kovash his yitzer, and that's why Chazal tell us, but makam shel ba'al tshuva omdim afilu tzadikim kemurim enim yochom lamad bo. So the Rambam seems to say a very similar idea over here, and that is that the struggle is so much greater in the limited experience that I've had in interaction with people who are in different stages of recovery from addictions of all different sorts. I have heard very, very similar accounts of individuals who undoubtedly struggle tremendously, and in no way whatsoever do they appreciate or celebrate the situation that they are in. But they will be able to say to you and reflect with tremendous, tremendous honesty and appreciation of themselves, that they have been able to discover strength within inside of themselves that they would never have known existed. The ability to exercise discipline and restraint and self-control when there's an enormous and a very strong urge is a very, very, very impressive human feat. And so therefore, the Rambam, Tosefos Yom HaKippurim, the Kiddush Levi as well, is teaching us over here that is the special zechus that Reish Lakish is referring to over here. When you can go ahead and you know what it is that you need to give up and you can still decide because of my Avas Hashem to cease and desist, I am no longer going to indulge in this chet, that in of itself is a tremendous, tremendous chus, and that's what it means that zdonos nasos kizchuyos. The next approach I will present to you comes from Reb Eliyahu Dessler in the Sefer Michtav Me'Eliyahu, and I will call this seeing the light. Reb Dessler, the way I understand it, basically says like this. He says, when a person does tshuva, the lights go on. Yeah? We sometimes use the expression, I've seen the light. A person is able to appreciate and to recognize that so many of the things that he had in his mind beforehand, the attitudes, the feelings, the beliefs, he had no idea what he was talking about. Right? A lot of times in life, particularly when people are younger. They think they know everything, they understand everything. They think that they've seen everything that there is to understand about the world. And so therefore they act in a certain way, thinking that I am acting willfully, I am acting intentionally. Now, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses to judge us, the capacity, again, going back to what we said beforehand, the great chesed of tshuva is in the following respect. And that is that rather than judge us based on one frame in our life, based on one particular act that I have done, HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at the totality of me and my entire life and my entire existence and recognize and gives me, if you will, credit for the fact that as I have matured, as I have become more enlightened, as I have brought myself closer to God, I recognize through a mixture of regret and enlightenment that I didn't know what I was talking about then. I didn't know what I was thinking. And says Rav Dessler, therefore, those donos, they become like shkagos, they are knocked down a level, because really, I didn't know what I was saying, I didn't know what I was thinking, I didn't know what I was doing. And he goes on to say, there's even a higher level. When a person does tshuva me'ava, the enlightenment is so great, it is so intense, that a person can even look back on mistakes from the past with such a new sense of clarity that it's as if the things that I did beforehand were zechuyos. I'm not sure that I understand exactly what that means for myself, but I'm presenting to you nonetheless. Rav Dessler seems to be saying over here that you can reach this madrega of clarity, of enlightenment in the process of tshuva, so much to the point that you look back on the things from the past and you say, I clearly had no hasaga. I had no idea what I was talking about. The fourth approach I will call above and beyond. And this comes from the Rabbi Yosef Alban, Sefer Ikrim, and the Slach has a similar approach as well. And that is that they both basically say, listen, don't try to understand this. It doesn't make any sense. We can try all we want to understand how could it be that Zdonos, Nasos, Kuzuchuyos, but the reality is, it is nothing more, nothing less than a gift from God. Rabbi Yosef Albo says over here, it is an reflection of the great divine kindness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us so much, and he gives us the ability to go ahead and not just wipe our slate clean, as we say, but convert our avonos into zchuyos. You can try to understand it, you won't understand it. That Tzlach says over here, it's a matnas chinam. He says it's tzedakah. You know the way matanos work. You know, sometimes you get a gift, you host somebody in your home, so they give you a gift. It wasn't necessary. I understand why you're giving me a gift. You're giving me a gift because you appreciate my hospitality. It's my birthday. You gave me a gift. Very, very nice. Thank you. But you didn't have to. But that's not a matnas chinam. Sometimes I'm giving you a gift. Why? Because I love you. No other reason. Just take it. Says the Tzlach, this idea that zdonos nasadlos kuzchuyos, it's tzedakah. Kadosh Baruch Hu nosin mishalom matana la'adam, and it's a midah yaseira, ein zami midas hamishpat. Don't try to understand it. It doesn't make sense. It's illogical from the perspective of Mishpat. We would say it's unjust. It is unjust. It does not reflect justice at all. It is b'midas rachamim gedolim shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the fourth approach we're presenting is basically don't even try to understand this in the first place. So we presented four different approaches. We presented the first approach, fuzzy math, no pain, no gain, seeing the light above and beyond. And what I'd like to do right now, with our time remaining, is to share with you an approach of Rav Soloveitchik, which is found in the Sefer Al HaTshuva. I'm sure that many of you know that the Rav gave many tshuva drushos over the course of years. These drushos were delivered in Yiddish, but they were many of them, not all of them, were transcribed into a book called Al HaTshuva, which is written in Hebrew. That book has since been translated into English on repentance, and I would highly recommend it if you have not had an opportunity to learn to study any of these drushos. There's a lot to be learned and a lot to be gained. So the Rav has a rather lengthy drasha where he touches on this topic. I am not going to present it in its totality to you, but what I'm going to try to do is extract some of the tamsis, the main idea, and share that with you. And we're going to break down some of the way the Rav presents this, and I'm going to do so by reading some of the quotes to you inside. I think it's very important to use as close as we can to the Rav's language over here when trying to convey this idea. Says the Rav as follows, Chote habala sos tshuva. When a person who is a sinner comes to do tshuva, amasim ra'im sh'asa ba'avar, for the evil deeds that he has committed in the past, the ain tshuva b'li charata la'avar, and of course, as we know, you cannot engage in the process of tshuva without having regret and remorse for what's been done in the past. What does he do with all of those years that he was immersed in chet? All of this, what does he do with that? They're, after all, they're haunting his memory. They're part of his identity. There are times where people sin for 10, 15 years. The Rav says of you, I know Jews who sinned for 70 years. 70 years. What does a person do when now he looks back? And he's trying to reckon with these years of Chil Shabbos, Oshek Gzela, Chil Shabbos and theft and fraud. So these are part of his identity. This is who I am. Do I continue with all of this as being part of my identity, part of my story, or do I erase it as if it never happened? There are situations where people erase parts of their life. Yadua, he says, for example, it is known that people who are imprisoned, when they are free, they try to forget. And maybe they succeed to forget the years that they were in prison because it is too painful for them. They erase the past. As the Pasuk says, Vlo Zachar Saramashkim is Yosef Ayishkacheyu. The Saramashkim forgot Yosef, said the Rav. He forgot Yosef because he probably just tried to forget that entire tzkufa life. He didn't want to remember that he was in prison at all. But says the Rav, when a person does this, Kishu Mochik Chelik Menavar, when a person erases part of his past, he cuts off part of his existence. His past shrinks. His part of his identity becomes dwarfed. And this operation, this surgical procedure, as the Rav refers to it metaphorically, is not easy. It's not easy for a person who's 50, 60 years old to go ahead and just wipe away a third, a half, three quarters of his life. So he says, Ma yase umu rotza lashuv b'tshuva b'shlav zeh b'chayiv. What does a person do if he wants to do tshuva at this stage in his life? How does he reconcile? How does he live with years of sin? Without having to acknowledge that this is in fact who I am, this is part of my identity. It would seem that the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva similarly presents a Baal Tshuva as someone who maybe should, in fact, try to erase this part of his past. The Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, in Perek Beis, Midarkei HaTshuva, among the ways, the methods of tshuva, person is shoved. The person who is shoved, tzoek tamed lefnei Hashem bebechi b'tachanunim, he cries out to God in expressions of plea for compassion and petitioning for forgiveness. He gives tzedakah, mishana shemo, maybe even changes his name. Kolomar, as if to say, ani acher, I am somebody else. Eini oso ish she'asa osan hamasim, I am not the same person. The Rambam is presenting over here a profile of a Baal Tshuva who literally cuts himself off from the person who existed beforehand. I am not the same person. This is an approach. This is one approach of Tshuva. And in fact, the Rav quotes, you know, we think we know so much about the life of Avraham Avinu. After all, there are multiple parshios in the Torah that are devoted to telling us about the life and times of Avraham. But says the Rav, you know, until Avraham was 43 years old, he was living another life, and we know nothing about that part of Avram's life. Here's what we know. Vayomer Hashem al Avram, Hashem says to Avram, Lech lecha, leave. Me'artzucha, from your land, the land in which you were raised. Leave the place in which you interacted with people for 43 years. The language that you spoke. Umi moladetecha, from the place that you were raised. Your friends, your childhood friends. Leave them behind. Umi beis avicha, your family, all that connected you to your past, leave it. El oretz asher areka, to a new place where I will take you. And the Rav points out, it's very powerful. Obviously, we've heard stories about Avraham Avinu. There's often Torah Shabbat Peh. The Chumash doesn't tell us about Avraham before this point. Lech lecha, leave. And Avraham is essentially, as the Rav says, he's essentially born again. He is born at that stage in his life. And in this case, his name is changed. Not yet, but ultimately he will have a name change. He will go from Avram to Avraham, a new person. Continues the Rav Hashela, the question, Im atshuvim hemshech o hefsek, whether tshuva is a continuation or a new beginning. Im hu mekayemes asavarim avatelos lagamri, whether it continues the past. It's a continuation, if you will, the next chapter, if it's a new book. It depends on the type of tshuva. Yesh tshuva shel hemshech. There is a tshuva of hemshech. Hamakira ba'avar, which recognizes and validates and names and sees the past for what it was. V'yesh tshuva shetachlisa bi'ur mukhlat shel hora. But there is another type of tshuva, which is an eradication of the past. Mikerev yishiyuso shel adam, from the identity of a person. Yesh matzavim shebehinein breira cheres masher bi'ura. There are situations, says the Rav, we have no choice. There are situations where a person has no choice but to uproot that from the source. And he goes on to say, interestingly, the example that he applies over here is not regarding an individual, but a group of people. He says, if we ignore our responsibility to uproot evil from its roots, then we could be facing a situation years later where we have to deal with the tragic loss of 6 million people. He says, the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, which the Torah instructs us to destroy an entire nation, is not because of racial hatred. A nation which embodies, which personifies evil, must be uprooted. Otherwise, it will continue to rear its ugly head. And says the Rav, the same is true with people. There are situations where a person has no choice but to engage in a tshuva, which is bebechinas hefsek, where I have completely detached myself from the past. Kol hachatoim v'amasim haroim she'asot shokim l'tahom, and I'm throwing them in the sea, as we said this morning as well. V'sashlich b'mitzulos yom kol chatosam, I cast my sins into the sea. And, says the Rav, when I do that, not only do I throw away my sins, but I throw away all of those days of my life. 10, 20, 30 years of sin. Ein kol efsharut lina'er es hachatoyim la'ashiv mekom es hashanim, says the Rav, maybe tragically there is no way to cast away the sins, but keep those days as part of my memory of myself, my identity. If I'm going to cut it off, then it all has to go. It's like amputating a limb. You can't keep the good parts. It's not the way it works. Now, the Rav, in such a beautiful and such a powerful way, points out that while there are times where a person may have no choice but to do this, or may not know of any other ways and chooses to do this, there is a downside to it. And the Rav employs over here and evokes a pasuk that we would never think to use in this respect, and that is the concept of Bal Tashchis. He says, you know, the Torah tells us in source number 26, when laying siege around the city, so if you have to cut down trees in order to prepare for certain military exercises, you cannot cut down fruit-bearing trees. That's the concept of Bal Tashchis. Now, we're familiar with the idea of Bal Tashchis, that you know, if there's extra food on the table, you want to throw it out. If you have an extra piece of furniture, instead of just throwing it in the garbage, you know, maybe call a few neighbors, put it out on the, you know, on Teaneck Shuls, and let people know, you know, if you're interested, I'm giving away this furniture for free. Because why would you want to throw something away? Why would you want to waste something of value? Says the Rav, the concept of Bal Tashchis applies to one's life as well. You know, it's not so simple to just go ahead and just throw away months, years of my life. That's me. That's part of my identity. It's part of who I am. These are years that I have lived. And there's a consideration over there of an iser, so to speak, of Bal Tashchis. Now, I want to share with you a story that the Gemara tells us in source number 27 regarding two individuals whom we have all heard of. Great Talmudic scholars, Amoraim, Reb Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who ultimately would become brothers-in-law. But the Gemara tells us that they didn't start at the same place, whereas Reb Yochanan was a scholar, as far as we know, his entire life. He was an individual who was in the category of, using the Gemara that we saw earlier, Tzadikim Gemurim. He was a Tzadik Gemur. Reish Lakish had a history which involved some pretty serious criminal activity. Reish Lakish was a felon. He was involved in armed robbery on a regular basis. This was what he did. And the Gemara tells us, a fascinating Gemara, Bav Metzia Daf Pei Dalet, Yom Echad, one day, have a kosachi Reb Yochanan b'Yardena. Reb Yochanan was bathing in the Yarden, in the Jordan River. Chaz Reish Lakish b'shaver l'Yardena basrei. So Reish Lakish saw him, and he decided to go and mug him. Here's a great opportunity to mug an old rabbi. Amr Leib, Reb Yochanan saw Reish Lakish. He said to him, Cheleich l'Oraisa. He says, wow, look at that strength you have. Look at that, the capacity you have to seize something when you want it. He says, we could use you in the Beis Medrash. Take that energy and channel it to Torah learning. Amr Leib, Reish Lakish said back to Reb Yochanan, Shufrach l'nashi. Okay, talk about changing the topic. He says, you know, you're very good looking. It's a shame that God wasted his good looks on you. That's the sort of good looks that, you know, should be relegated to women. So Amr Leisa, he says, listen, if you do tshuva, if you come back, then I'll introduce you to my sister. The Shapira, you know, she's even more beautiful than I am. So Rabbi Yochanan, you know, says to Rish Lakish, okay, you know, if this is what is attracting you to me, good, I'm happy to introduce you to my sister. Come with me to the base medrash. Kobil Olay, says the Gemara, Rish Lakish says, okay. And Akri Va'asne, and they begin a relationship that carried them literally to the last days of their life, as the Gemara goes on to tell us. And Rabbi Yochanan tutored him and he taught him in Chumash and in Mishnah, and slowly but surely he became, as the Gemara says, a Gavra Rabba. He became the great Reish Lakish. He became one of the greatest Torah scholars in our history. Yomachad Havim Miflugu Bei Midrasha, says the Gemara, one day there was a machlokas in the Beis Medrash. They were arguing about a very technical point in Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara regarding certain weapons, a sayif, a sakin, swords and spears and knives. At which point are they mekabel tumah? So the Gemara says, obviously, at the time of Gemar Melacha, when their production, their manufacturing process has been completed. And when is that, says the Gemara? So Rabbi Yochanan says, Mishi Yitztarfin Bekivshan, when they have become forged in the furnace, when you put them into the furnace and they're exposed to that intense heat, that's at that point, that's the Gemar Melacha. Reish Lakish says, no. Mishi Yitzachzuchan B'mayim. After you take them, put them in the Kivshan, you have to put them in water. And when you put them in water, that's the Gemar Melacha. So Omer Leisa, Rav Yochanan turns to Reish Lakish and he says, ah, listob listiyuse yada, which basically means, I mean, not literally, but he's saying, ah, once a criminal, always a criminal. Look, you know this avodah, this Melacha. You remember it from the good old days when you were a criminal, and now you are enlightening all of us. You should know the Mefarshim struggle to understand exactly how would Rabbi Yochanan could say that? Why would he remind him of his evil past? Maybe he was even doing this in public, which is more difficult to understand. But leaving that aside, it caused Reish Lakish to stop for a moment, to pause, and he says, you know, he sort of says, Taki, you're right. Umaya honestly, Hasam Rebbe Karuli, Hacha Rebbe Karuli. You know, they called me Rebbe there. I was the head of the bandits back then, and now I'm a Rebbe here in the Beis Medrash. What? How have you benefited me by bringing me from there to here? And Amr Leh, and this is say, sort of the punchline of the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan says, "Dimahanilach dikravinach tachas kanfi ashchina," which the Rav seems to understand and to explain in the following way. He says, "We need you here. You have added to this conversation. We were talking about at which point a certain kelim mekabel tumah." And you were able to enlighten us. You brought from your experiences from the past a perspective that none of us had. And as a result, we are all the better for it. And I believe, that this is how the Rav is using this Gemara. It is not only to be understood in its most limited sense over here in terms of the story in the Gemara, but much more broadly than that. That Reish Lakish, who was feeling a little bit of an identity crisis at this moment, not knowing exactly who he was and feeling very insecure with who he was and the decisions that he's made in the past, is now at a point where he is starting to second guess himself and say, wait a second, I'm not worthy. How can I? How can I sit here with the rest of you? I was Rebbe there. What's changed? And the answer is, you're not the same person. You are better than you would have otherwise been. You are bringing your past into your place today and into our future. Says the Rav in source number 28, a Baal Tshuva who knows how to hold on to the past and not to forget the past, not to just tear out the pages of his diary, to use them to catalyze growth going forward. He is able to elevate himself and the sin to a place of greatness. Ligabov says the Rav, this is so powerful. HaKadosh Baruch Hu eino over al pesha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not passing over his sin. Ela no se avon vafesha. He is carrying it. He is raising it. He is raising it to a high level because your sin in this respect has made you greater than you otherwise would have been. The next source, which is a long source, which we're not going to read inside together, I imagine that some of you are familiar with it. It comes from the collection of letters that were published between Rav Huttner and correspondence that he had with other people. This is in Pachad Yitzchok, the volume that is dedicated to these letters of correspondence. And this is perhaps in some ways one of the most famous of all, in which Rav Huttner receives a letter from a Talmud who is struggling. He's struggling in yeshiva. It's not so unusual what this Talmud was reporting, but, you know, he was having a difficult time, probably sleeping late and not connecting so much with the learning and wondering whether this was really for him where he should be and having a difficult time. So he did the good thing. He decided to reach out to a Rebbe and to discuss this with him. Unfortunately, many people who feel this, you know, may just sort of keep it to themselves, and sometimes that can grow over time and cause a lot of unnecessary angst and guilt. So he writes to Rav Huttner, "What should I do? I'm struggling too much." So Rav Huttner, in a very surprising way, begins this letter by basically saying, you know, I got your wonderful letter, and I'm so happy. It sounds amazing. Now, on the surface, that's a very strange response to a guy who just, you know, poured his heart out and says, I'm having a really difficult time. And Rav Huttner goes on to say, you know, your struggle is great, because this means that you ultimately are on your path to greatness, or that you could be on your path to greatness. And Rav Huttner uses this opportunity to lament the fact that, unfortunately, there are so many books that are published which talks about the accomplishments of Gedolei Yisrael. We call them sometimes Gadol books, which talks about this Rebbe and this Rav and this Rosh Yeshiva and how they were amazing, and they were amazing in all areas, and Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim, and the stories that we tell are so incredibly inspiring. But says Rav Huttner, the unfortunate thing is they never tell the stories of how they messed up and all the struggles and the mishaps along the way. They never tell them. And they leave, unfortunately, the naive reader with the impression that these people were just sort of born this way. And rather than be inspired on a certain level, the person who's reading this feels worse and worse about themselves over time, because I can never be that, because I struggle. I have moments of difficulty and uncertainty and doubt, and I mess up and I sin. And says Rav Huttner, it's so unfortunate. And he gives an example that I would never say if Rav Huttner didn't, so forgive me. He says, you know, we all talk about the Taras HaLashon of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim literally wrote the book on Lashon Hara. We speak about the purity of speech of the Chafetz Chaim. He says, who knows about all the mechamos, the mavavakim, the mecholim, and the filos, and his yonos? Who knows about all the times that the Chafetz Chaim messed up? It's hard to imagine that the Chafetz Chaim struggled and that he himself spoke in a way that he shouldn't. And somebody had to say to him, excuse me, we don't talk that way. So he says, the problem is you think that your struggles are a sign of weakness. Your struggles are a sign of strength. And he goes on to say, it's so beautiful. Lose the battle, win the war. Your quest as an Eved Hashem should not be on every battle, but it's rather to win the war and to recognize and to appreciate that it's dafka within the struggle that greatness is born. Sheva yipov tzadik v'kam. He quotes the pasuk from Mishlei that a tzadik becomes a tzadik not because he falls. I'm sorry, not because he gets up, but because he falls. It's the nefilos that make the tzadik the tzadik. And so, therefore, Rav Huttner, I believe, in sort of addressing this issue, is reminding each and every one of us that you shouldn't think that because of the fact that you are struggling, that you have messed up, that you have red marks on your record, that you are somehow inferior, that you are unworthy, that you are inadequate, that you can't sit at the dais with the tzaddikim gemurim. Quite to the contrary, b'makom shebalei tshuva omdim, afilu tzaddikim gemurim einam omdim. Continues the Rav, this is the last source from Al Hashuva that we'll read together inside. Lo'or zeh, says the Rav, yuvanu lanu ato divrei Reish Lakish hamuvoim lamala. We can now understand Reish Lakish. Gedola tshuva shizdonos nasas lo kishgagos. Says Rav Huttner, tshuva is so great because, I'm sorry, says Reish Lakish, tshuva is so great shizdonos nasas lo kishgagos, that yuzdonos become like shgagos, like accidental sins. Medubar kan b'tshuva shel biyu hara. Says the Rav, we are talking about what type of tshuva? The tshuva of eradication of the past. Tshuva zumocheches as avonos. It erases the sins. Aval in mafricha. But it does not create in a mefareshun davar chadash. It does not plant. It does not germinate anything new. Has donos nasus kishgagos ki ilu lohayu. It's like it never existed. Hein nimchakos, they are erased. Aval b'mamashen yishay Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish in his second maimer, where he says, gedola tshuva shez donos nasa lo kishuyos. Hakavana l'tshuva shaha lo asara. This is the idea of tshuva, of elevating the sin, elevating the evil. Tshuva zu goremes lo adam shiasa mitzvos b'yeser oz v'omets me'asher osos l'nei shachata. A person is able to do, to serve Hashem with greater focus and intensity and alacrity. She yilma Torah cheres mimashe lomad osa l'nei achet. The Torah he learns is a different Torah. Qualitatively, it's different. What did he do to deserve becoming the Chavrusa of Rabbi Yochanan, who was the Rosh Amori Eretz Yisrael? The answer is, what he did was, he lived a life of crime. And the tshuva that followed enabled him to convert that into such goodness, which he was able to apply to Limud Torah, which catapulted him to new levels and height. Says the Rav that the tshuva of Biur Hara is tshuva Meira. When a person engages in tshuva Meira, they eradicate the past. And there are times, as he said, there are times where in fact, indeed, that is what needs to happen. But tshuva Meyava is when a person is able to elevate the past, to incorporate all of my mistakes along the way into my identity, into my present and my future. And by doing so, we can say, Gedola tshuva shemagas ad kisei hakavod. Gedola tshuva shezdonos nasas lo kizchuyos. It becomes part of my the next chapter of my life, which incorporates, includes, and validates and recognizes the chapters which preceded. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells us that David HaMelech was somehow able to be making olo shel tshuva. Exactly what it means, it's not easy to understand exactly what that means, but apparently, until David HaMelech came along, the world was missing an example, a paradigm of tshuva, the likes of which David HaMelech was able to create. Why? Well, first of all, where they see that? The pasuk at the end of Shmuel Beis tells us, Eila divrei David Achron, the last words of David, Nu'um David ben Yishai, Nu'ma Gever, Hukam, Ol, Mashiach, Elokei, Yaakov, Nizim, Yisrael. The pasuk gives all these accolades describing David, including Nu'um HaGever, the words of Gever, who come all. And the Gemara says he was making Olo Shel Tshuva. Apparently, even though Adam HaRishon was about Tshuva, and Cain was about Tshuva, and there were many other Bali Tshuva along the way, Sefer Bereishis, we learn about Bali Tshuva, Ruve, Yehuda, Tzad, Kami, many, there were great Bali Tshuva. But there was something that David was able to contribute that others could not. What is that? I'm not sure, I don't know. Again, many have discussed this. But I'd like to suggest that perhaps we can get some perspective from another Gemara. His Gemara comes from the end of Maseches Pesachim. This is a rather remarkable, and in some respects, at least the way I present it, it's a little bit of a humorous Gemara, but you know, you could draw your own conclusions. The Gemara tells us that Asir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lasas suda letzadikim. It's not easy to understand what this means. Let's understand it however we can understand. But in the future, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will make a suda for tzadikim. There will be a meal. And who's going to be present at this meal? This is going to be all the VIPs from our history. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Moshe, Yeshua, David, they're all going to be sitting there. La'achar she'ochlen v'she'osin. So after they have a meal, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Avram Avinu a kos shebracha, and he says, can you please lead the benching? Again, I'm going to say for the last time, it's a little bit of a strange situation to imagine over here. But they pass Avram the kos, and they say, please leave the benching. So he says, eini mevarech. I'm not comfortable leading the bench. Why? Shiyatza mimeni Yishmael. I had a son, Yishmael. I'm not particularly proud of him and some of the decisions that he made, and so therefore I would rather pass. Okay. I'm not really sure exactly how that works and how you say no when the Rabbanu Shalom asks you to bench, but okay. So they turn to Yitzchak and they say, Yitzchak, Tol uvarech, please, can you please lead the benching? So he says, I'd rather not. Eini mevarech, shiyatza mimeni Yesav. Okay, you probably saw that coming. So he turned to Yaakov. Yaakov, please, can you lead the benching? After all, you had lots of wonderful children. There shouldn't be any problems here. Yaakov says, eini mevarech, I don't want to bench. Shenasasi shtei achoyis b'chayei, and I married two sisters in their lifetime, and in the end, the future of the Torah would forbid that. I don't feel worthy of benching in your presence. Okay, turn to Moshe. Can you please lead the benching? I can't lead the benching. I didn't go to Eretz Israel. Yeshua, can you lead the benching? I cannot have the... Nobody wants to lead the benching. So it seems, the Gemara is almost seems to imply from a place of total desperation, Kadosh Baruch Hu turns to David and says, David HaMelech, can you lead the benching? Now you all know it's complicated to discuss the life of David HaMelech, what exactly he did, what he didn't do. But David HaMelech did not have a perfect record, did not have a stellar record. David HaMelech takes the coast and he says, Ani avarech veli no'el avarech. Yes, I will lead the benching, and it should be me. I'm happy to, and it's appropriate for me to lead the benching. Shenemar, as he quotes the pasuk, Kos Yeshuos Eso v'Shem Hashem Ekra. He lifts the I lift my cup of salvation, and call in the name of God. It's as if David HaMelech was saying, I recognize fully my mistakes of the past. I acknowledge them, as he says, famous words, Chatasi Lashem. I'm not denying it. It is part of my past. It is part of my identity. And I am better for it. One who engages in Shuvah Me'ava, Zdonos Nasos Kizuchuyos. The way the Rav explained the Tshuva, the transformation of Reish Lakish, it would seem, when the Gemara is telling us that what was so great about David HaMelech, Shehekim Olah Shel Tshuva, that he raised the concept of tshuva for the world to see in a sterling example, that you could have stains on your record, but you can go ahead and you can transform yourself through the process of tshuva into a person who is better for it. I'd like to share with you a quote from Viktor Frankl in the book Man's Search for Meaning, a book which I highly encourage each and every one of you to read. He writes, the pessimist resembles a man who observes with fear and sadness that his wall calendar, from which he daily tears a sheet, grows thinner with each passing day. On the other hand, the person who attacks the problems of life actively is like a man who removes each successive leaf from his calendar and files it neatly and carefully away with its predecessors, after having first jotted down a few diary notes on the back. He can reflect with pride and joy on all the richness set down on these notes, on all of that his life has already lived to the fullest. What will it matter to him if he notices that he is growing old? Has he any reason to envy the young people whom he sees or wax nostalgic over his lost youth? What reasons has he to envy a young person for the possibilities that a young person has, the future which is in store for him? No, thank you, he will think. Instead of possibilities, I have realities in my past. Not only the reality of work done and of love loved, but of sufferings bravely suffered. These sufferings are even the things of which I am most proud, although these are the things which cannot inspire envy. We can take the suffering of our lives, even the self-induced suffering, and incorporate that into who we are today, and to reflect upon this, like he says, with a sense of pride and faith in myself in terms of who I am today. Now, I want to share with you, it's hard for you to see this, the entire thing at once, so I'm actually not going to touch it, because I don't want to ruin it. Maybe I'll lower it in a second so you can see the entire screen. This is a half of a page coming from the archives of the drashos of Rabbi Norman Lam, Zichron Levracha, who was nifter a little more than a year ago. And Rabbi Lam's drashos are all available online. Some of you may know that. You can just Google them. Feel free to do so, and you'll be taken to an archive which will show you hundreds of drashos over the course of an amazing career, in which Rabbi Lam, his drashos are there. Some of them have been published and edited, and many of them, are available in their original form. And hopefully you can see on your screen right now what I mean by that. So here you have a drasha that was given 70 years ago today. It looks like it was intended for Rosh Hashanah, but was ultimately given on Shabbat Shuvah 1951. And in this drasha, it just so happens Rabbi Lam talks about some of the ideas that we have been discussing today. I'm not going to do that now. But what I want you to see, what I love about these drashas, is that they remind me of how much we lose in our world, in which we are so obsessed with the delete button. Should anyone at any point in the future have any interest in looking at my archives? I have archives. They're already digitized. All of my archives, the drushas and shiurim that I've given over the past two decades, are there. And they are nothing but clean, edited, spell-checked, pristine works of visual art. I cannot comment on the content of these drushos, but certainly the appearance. But I'll tell you what's missing, and I'll tell you what's sorely lacking. And when you look at the beauty of Rabbi Lamb's drusha, look at the struggle, the mistakes, the crossouts, the whiteouts, the uncertainty. Here, I'll lower it a little bit. The revisions, the way, and you can literally, I'm not going to do this right now, but you could literally almost see the struggle that he was having with certain words. And this is the way that we should try to remember him and all great people who have preceded us. People who struggled, people who made mistakes. This is part of their legacy. And most important, it's the way that we should try to remember ourselves as imperfect individuals who have lots of crossouts and stains and spelling mistakes and grammatical errors, omissions and commissions, and we are all the better for it. I want to share with you one final source, which comes from a TED Talk that I heard several years ago, actually in some ways sort of inspired everything that I'm sharing with you tonight. This had a tremendous impact on me at the time. I was very, very inspired when I heard this woman, Nora McLerney, who I believe is just a pretty ordinary woman, who had a fantastic TED Talk and probably made her famous, not just in the moment, but since as well. And I would recommend that you, strongly recommend that you listen to this yourself. It's pretty easy to find. It's like 20 minutes. And what you have over here on your page, which I'll read to you in a moment, is not words that she wrote, but rather it's a transcription of the words that she said. But I think convey a very, very powerful sentiment and apply the ideas that we've been sharing beyond the concept of tshuva in its most limited sense, but just in terms of coming to terms with loss and grief in general. So she says, and this is again part of a quote, and forgive me for reading it to you, but I think it's part of our presentation, it's kedai. So 2014 was a big year for me. Do you ever have that, like a big year, like a banner year? For me, it went like this. October 3rd, I lost my second pregnancy. And then October 8th, my dad died of cancer. And then on November 25th, my husband Aaron died after 3 years with stage 4 glioblastoma, which is just a fancy word for brain cancer. Now, since 2014, I will tell you, I've remarried a very handsome man named Matthew. We have 4 children and our blended family. We live in the suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota, USA. We have a rescue dog. I drive a minivan, like the kind where the doors open and I don't even have to touch them. By any measure, life is really good. Really good. But I haven't moved on. I haven't moved on, and I hate that phrase so much, and I understand why other people do. Because what it says is that Aaron's life and death are just, and love are just moments that I can leave behind me, and that I probably should. When I met Matthew, there was an audible sigh of relief among the people who love me. Like, it's over, she did it. She got a happy ending. We can all go home. We did good. And that narrative is so appealing even to me. And I thought maybe I had gotten that too, but I didn't. I got another chapter, and it's such a good chapter. It's such a good chapter. But especially at the beginning, it was like an alternate universe or one of those old choose-your-own-adventure books from the 80s where there are 2 parallel plot lines, and all of a sudden, those 2 plots were unfurling at once, and falling in love with Matthew really helped me realize the enormity of what I lost when Aaron died. And just as importantly, it helped me realize that my love for Aaron and my grief for Aaron and my love for Matthew are not opposing forces. They are just strands of the same thread. They are the same stuff. And as part of my job, this weird podcast that I have, I sometimes talk to people about the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And sometimes that's the loss of someone they love. Sometimes days ago or weeks ago, years ago, even decades ago. And these people that I interview, they haven't closed themselves around the loss and made it the center of their lives. They've lived. Their worlds have kept spinning. But they're talking to me, a total stranger, about the person they love who has died, because these are the experiences that mark us and make us just as much as the joyful ones. And just as permanently, long after you get your last sympathy card or your last hot dish, like we don't look at the people around us experiencing life's joys and wonders and tell them, move on, do we? We don't send another card that's like, congratulations on your beautiful boy, and then 5 years later say, another birthday party? Get over it. Yeah, we get it. He's 5. What can we do other than to try to remind one another that some things can't be fixed and not all wounds are meant to heal? We need each other to remember, to help each other remember, that grief is this multitasking emotion. That you can and will be sad and happy, you'll be grieving and able to love in the same year or week, the same breath. We need to remember that a grieving person is going to laugh again and smile again. If you're lucky, they'll even find love again. But yes, absolutely, they're going to move forward. but that doesn't mean that they've moved on. And although she doesn't reference this, I will share with you below. Lois Tonkin, who is a grief counselor, who presents two models of grief. What you see in front of you is the illustration, which has a barrel, or I should say a jar rather, with a ball inside. The black ball represents one's grief. So on the left, you have maybe sort of a traditional, typical, assumed model of grief, in which a person's life is consumed with grieving a particular loss, and then over time, we hope and we tell people that grief will subside. It will get smaller and smaller. It will shrink, and you will be able to breathe again. And what Tonkin suggests on the right is a different model to understand how grief and coping with loss and grief actually does work and should work, and that is that the ball doesn't shrink. The grief doesn't get smaller. The loss doesn't get smaller. But I expand. The jar expands over time. And suddenly I am at a place where I am able to cope with it from a different perspective. I'm no longer gasping for air. I have figured out how to move forward. Again, not necessarily move on, but move forward. I have figured out how to go ahead and to incorporate this particular event, this particular loss, into part of my life, my persona, in a way that doesn't require me to go ahead and to erase it from my past, but rather to incorporate it into myself and my future. I want, before concluding my remarks this evening, I want to spend a moment talking about the situation which we continue to face in the world today. And that is a word that I haven't mentioned once because it hasn't been relevant yet. But we still are living through a time which is particularly difficult. The continuing experience of the COVID coronavirus pandemic, which has affected all of us in many, many different ways. Now, I'm not going to talk at all about it in that sense, but I want to just acknowledge and name and just spend a minute to speak with you about the fact that we all feel like we want so desperately to move on. We just want this to be over. It has been so disruptive and so difficult and so challenging to each and every one of us. And needless to say, I'm not going to attempt to predict when this will be behind us, but here's something that I think we all should consider tonight. And that is that we should remember how in the early hours and days and maybe weeks of this terrible pandemic, how much we reflected with awe and with marvel as the world suddenly came to a halt, and we stopped and we committed ourselves to periods of deep reflection in which we were really seriously thinking about our values, our priorities, our lifestyles, how we live our life. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that would show and that would indicate, in my experience personally and in conversations with people 18, 19 months ago, was that people were really, 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 for the first time in their life, seeing things from a place of tremendous clarity. And there was a real genuine interest at the time to really change, to figure out how we can, when this is all over and behind us, how we can move forward. Now, as far as I can tell, the way things are going at the moment, if we do emerge from this period as changed people, it will not be for the better. I do not see in myself or in others a commitment nor a resolve to take anything positive from the last 19 months. We don't want to move forward. We want to move on. And that's such a shame, because we spoke about so many opportunities that this dreadful situation has afforded us that we can look at life differently. Relationships, social distancing. We had been put in a place where, because of circumstances beyond our control, we could not interact with people the way we had been accustomed to. And we were afforded an incredible opportunity to just think about our relationships from a different perspective, how we interact with people. And you would think that at this point in time, we would see a lot of evidence that relationships overall have been enhanced, that people have been able to discover new opportunities and new ways and new pathways to communicate with another, to reach out to people, to maybe connect with people that I haven't seen before, or I haven't reached out to in the past. And I'm not seeing that. And I hate to, you know, sound like, you know, such a pessimist over here, But all I'm seeing is relationships that seem strained more than ever before, that have been suffering in tremendous ways, and in the worst case scenario, that have been completely destroyed. And maybe some of that is inevitable. I recognize that this is not necessarily something that is happening willfully, that people are not choosing to sabotage their relationships, but at the very least, you would think that we would also be seeing an enhancement. We spoke about our relationship with institutions, with shuls, and with schools. We, you know, for many, many months, people had to daven at home. And when you daven at home, you couldn't talk. You couldn't talk to anybody else. There was nobody to talk to. And then slowly we started davening outside. And when you were davening outside, you also couldn't really talk to people because you were 6 feet away and we were wearing masks. And we were told we had to disperse as soon as davening was over. And then we went back into shul. And I naively thought that I would never see a person talk again in shul. How could you? How could a person talk in shul after having been put through a situation where for many, many months I couldn't daven with anyone else? I was denied the opportunity to daven with a minyan, people who were saying Kaddish, who couldn't say Kaddish for a loved one for many, many months. Hayitachin, that any person who experienced that can then go ahead and just find their way back to where they were beforehand? We had, I thought, very serious conversations and moments to reflect upon the size and the nature of our simchas. I'm just bringing it up over here, not because I'm not looking to bring the topic up again. I think the point has been made, and there's nothing that I'm going to say right now which is going to suddenly change anything. But for the record, I would like to say how profoundly disappointed I am in all of us as a community, that we were able to look at the videos and the pictures of weddings that were happening in people's backyards with 10, 15, 20 people and say, you know, that's beautiful. There's something special about that. And I recognize that there was a lot of pain in that as well. I recognize that. And it wasn't all good, but there was some good in that. And now, for months now, for years, from the very beginning, people just sort of crawling their way to get back to the place we were beforehand, as if that was the way. There was a petition that was going around. I don't remember, hundreds, maybe a couple of thousand names of people. We commit going forward to downsize our simchas. I don't know if that list is still out there. And if it is, and they're doing it, wonderful. Tavo aleihem bracha. My impression is, at least in the world in which I live right now, that ship has sailed. We're not, no. Unless there are some literal, you know, unless there are some very, very acute safety issues, if there are government orders, okay. Other than that, let's just go back to the way it was beforehand. And forgive me, I don't mean to put a number on it. $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, whatever it's going to cost to make the simcha. And again, I'm not bringing this up because I naively expect to think that, now, somehow it's going to sink in. As much as I am reflecting with a fair degree of sadness, that it's unfortunate that we can experience something as life-changing as this, and we could be so ready to move on and not move forward. It's not over. It's not too late for us. We talked about dating. We talked about spending money in general. There were so many aspects of this pandemic which we were forced to just take a look at the way we were doing things and saying, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a better way. And I'm just, if it's there, I'm not seeing it enough. I'm just seeing all of us understandably exhausted and tired and worn and broken and frustrated and just want to move on. But I encourage you to take the message of tonight's learning, and that is to not be so quick to move on. Maybe we can move forward. Of course we want to move on. Of course we want this to be behind us. It goes without saying. But what can we take from it? 20 years ago today, 9/11, a day that is seared into our memories. Did we change? And don't tell me, yeah, because we have to take off our shoes at the airport. And now I know that if I see something, I should say something. Did we change in more substantive ways? I remember, and I'm sure many who are listening remember as well, in the days after 9/11, a feeling of just wanting to hug anyone and everyone who would let me. It didn't matter who you were and whether we saw eye to eye on anything. I remember the yearning for Mashiach like I had never in my life. I remember saying, I love you, to my parents, who I don't say I love you to enough, to my siblings. Can you imagine? Unprompted. Why? Just because. I remember saying Moda Ani in the days after 9/11 with a tshuka that I hadn't ever until then in my life. I remember developing a genuine sense of Kovod Rosh, just an appreciation of life. And of course, it's to be understood. It is understandable that 20 years later, it's not going to feel just the same. I'm not expecting of myself, and I'm certainly not asking, demanding of anybody else, that you should feel today like it's the day after. Today is a very significant day. 20 years is certainly a moment to reflect. But what it does highlight for us is the capacity of the human being to move on. The capacity is there, as the Rav said, to erase parts of our past as if they'd never happened. But it's not the only capacity that we have. It's not our only nature. We could choose to be people who engage in tshuva meyira, but we could also be tshuva meyava people. I could choose to cut away the painful parts of my life, the uncomfortable experiences, the mistakes and the failures, the pain and the suffering. Do I want to just hit that delete button and erase from my memory, my conscience, my personality, to simply cut my losses and move on? Or maybe do I want to hold on to that pain and to the suffering, the setbacks and the failures, and embrace it and weave it into my personality, not only my past, but my future as well? Do I want to learn how to incorporate every moment of my life, the good, the bad, and the ugly, into who I am today and into my future? So I not take the easy way out by moving on, but rather strive to discover all of the gains along the way as I boldly and courageously make the decision to move forward. I thank you very much for joining me. I'm wishing each and every one of you a Gemar Chasima Tova, a year of health, happiness, and fulfillment for you, for your family, and for all of Klal Yisrael. Thank you.